So our first two panels this morning focused on the bigger picture, macroeconomics and finance. Now we're going to drill down to the human level, where change has in fact been the greatest and most visible in Cuba so far. As we've already heard, official numbers place the number of cuentapropistas, or self-employed, at about 500,000. However, my own calculations, if you add in private farmers, non-authorized informal sector, gray area firms, as well as moonlighting, that is to say, people who during the day work in state-owned enterprises, in the evenings and on the weekends work also in the private sector, one foot in each. You could have as many, in fact, as many as 2 million Cubans, 40% of the active labor force, working at least one foot already in the private sector. That's a much more potent and larger force than is commonly recognized in the official statistics and conversations. These self-employed firms were the first out of the gate. They have changed the face of Havana and other major urban centers. Many of them are industrious, they're courageous, and they've captured the imagination also of the international media. Now, here's one of the big questions for this panel now. Are these imaginative small-scale enterprises the cutting edge of economic transformation? Are they building momentum, creating new constituencies toward an inevitable march toward a more market-oriented socialism? Or are these small-scale businesses merely a safety valve, sopping up unemployment and providing some better consumer services, but all within the traditional framework of a centralized state socialism? That's one of the big questions we'll discuss on this panel. As Ted Henkin has already pointed out and will point out, the number of cuentapropistas seems to have plateaued at around 500,000. What are the big obstacles to their further expansion? Can the new Obama offers on the table in expanding tourism, remittances, trade with the private sector, which is on the table, not yet picked up, can that new Obama offer stimulate a second surge and ignite a new stage in private sector expansion? John McIntyre on the panel will give us some inspiring stories about very recent innovations in cross-straits ITC services. Then we also have non-agricultural co-ops that have been slow to take off, but now the government seems committed to shedding at least the many government restaurants and other petty services and transforming them into market, into worker-managed cooperatives. Can these new cooperatives become a major pillar of the new Cuban economy? And will these cooperatives be truly independent entities? We're lucky to have with us, as our lead speaker now, Rafael Betancourt, who will go into this. So now, without further ado, let me quickly introduce our three panelists. You have their bios. All of them have deep roots in Cuba. Rafael Betancourt, an economics degree from the University of Florida, now a professor at the University of Havana. He has decades of experience in international development and project management. He's currently with Havanada Consulting. Rafael is a leading authority on this new field of non-state cooperatives in Cuba. He'll be followed by Ted Henkin, a sociologist at Baruch College. With impressive foresight, Ted wrote his dissertation a decade ago on this very topic of microenterprises in Cuba. He remains a foremost authority on the subject. He recently published, with Arch Ritter from the earlier panel, the book Entrepreneurial Cuba, The Changing Policy Landscape. Ted maintains the popular blog El Yuma. And then finally, John McIntyre, who was born in Cuba, retired in 2004 from a successful career in investment banking. He's now an early-stage investor in education technology. John is a co-founder of Cuba Emprende, the largest entrepreneur training program and small-scale business incubator in Cuba. They'll speak in that order. Rafael.
How do I get this going?
This way.
Can somebody give me some help here? Okay, we go. We got it. Good morning. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Brookings Institute, for inviting me. My first three or four slides are about the statistics, basically, of the non-state sector compared to the state sector, so I hope you can distribute those minutes and charge them for it, too, because they're going to make use of it. Okay. Basically, the employment in the state and non-state sector has actually, you can see the figure there, the employment in the state sector has decreased somewhat in these last 5 years. And the state sector, the employment in the other state sector, because other private are mostly farmers, so small farmers, together with the cuentapropistas, or the actually people who have licenses to practice an activity that is legally allowable to be done privately. These are the figures that we're picking up here. And the cooperativistas, the number of members of cooperatives, which do not include the small farmers that are in CCS or in the Cooperativas de Crédito y Servicio, which are the ones that group private farmers and provide credit and services, has basically leveled. If we look at the new cooperatives, we see... We look at the percentage of women. It's a very interesting thing that the state enterprises have 45% of the employment are women. But as you go down to the private sector, you have a significant reduction in the number of women, particularly in the farmers and the private license holders. And in cooperative, you have 14% in the agricultural and 22% in the non-agricultural. These women, these young women, are both students of mine. They have a small stained glass window cooperative in Old Havana. As we can see, in terms of the number of economic units, the number of cooperatives has actually declined from over 6,000 to around 5,000, 5,500 in the last few years, because there's been a consolidation of cooperatives, and some have actually failed to maintain their effectiveness or productivity, and they have been converted turned over as leased land to small farmers. The number of enterprises has also declined, but incredibly, as we were mentioning today, as Saida was saying, and Yaima, there has not been a reduction in the public enterprises, the public administered enterprises, which would be the budget, unidades presupuestadas, or the budgeted sector. So we hear a lot, but the number of budgeted units has remained relatively the same. If we look at the cooperatives themselves, the farmers and workers cooperatives, there has been basically relatively stability in the ones, the CCS, which are the ones that group private farmers, and the CPAs and the UBPCs have actually declined a little bit. And so the statistics show for the first time the number of cooperatives in 2013 that are non-agricultural. So this is the first time it appears in the statistics. So focusing on the non-agricultural cooperatives, I don't like to use a negative term. It just seems that you don't characterize something, but it is not. Omar Eleni likes to call them urban cooperatives. I'm hoping that some of these will also be in rural areas someday. So I call them service and manufacturing cooperatives. There have been 498 approved a year ago. And I don't know if the new statement that Juan was referring to speaks about a new group. We've been waiting for a new group to be announced, but it hasn't been yet. So we're about a year into a process that has no new set of cooperatives approved. And of these, 329 are operational. A third of those are retail markets, farmers markets, basically, that have been turned over from the state to their workers. There are in other activities as well. 53% are in Havana, and some are the other two provinces that have the most are Artemisa and Matanzas. By the way, I'm with Matanzas baseball team, not Havana. Just to make a note here. Sorry for you. So, but the important thing is that there's a concentration. I was teaching last year in Guantanamo, and I could barely see the presence of the private sector or cooperative or the urban cooperatives. I think there's one in Guantanamo. So again, the point that there is Havana and then that it's not Cuba is a very important point to make. 77% are former state-owned enterprises that have been turned over to its workers, and only 23% are grassroots initiatives. And that has a lot to do with the fact that you can only form a cooperative based on the 201 activities that are approved. And those activities are practically only three that are professional. Translator, interpreter. I have a license as a translator interpreter, Juan. You should try to get that. That's good. I'm a self-employed licensed TCP. There is one for carrying out accounting services, and the third one, which I don't remember. Those are the other three. So you have a limit there, a cap. There are over 500 applications that are pending. The service and manufacturing co-ops, I just put some figures, some photographs here. And the last one is the cooperative of ornithologists. They're the only ones that are allowed to export. They haven't done too well, but they are the only ones. So we have a precedent. There is one cooperative that is allowed to export. So there's we're expecting another, the announcement was made of another 13,000 new small and medium-sized enterprises by 2017, all coming from MINSIN, from the Ministry of Internal Trade or Domestic Trade. They will basically split off about 9,000 into cooperatives, and the smaller ones that have four or less workers into basically units with private workers that lease the facilities from the state. And I just wanted to note a few, just some achievements of these cooperatives in the short period that they have been working. One is that these are, many of these are, the government itself is admitting to these achievements, more and better services and products, and a very real public acceptance. The people are really, in Cuba, are really optimistic for the cooperatives. There's a sense of belonging and ownership that its members are developing. They have definitely achieved higher incomes, sometimes three, four times the previous income. And they have established commercial relations with agricultural cooperatives and private workers, whereas they've had a lot more difficult time in establishing commercial relations with state suppliers. The grassroots non-agricultural cooperatives have shown more ability in legal issues, accounting, marketing, and management. Problems. Just very, very quickly go over them. The question of inputs, the provisions for these, this is their first and major complaint. Every time you speak to a non-agricultural cooperative, they complain about this. The lack of a wholesale market, the lack of planning of, they're not included in the state plans. So therefore that there's not a particular amount of goods that are destined for them. They have to compete with the state enterprises. There is variable support by their relevant ministry. They're always connected to a ministry. Some ministries, like transportation, have provided a lot of support. Others, very little. There is a very certain uncertainty about the future of their capital goods, which right now belong to the state, but they are basically paying them through the maintenance and so on. So at some point, for example, the buses to the urban bus cooperative, well, they are basically going to pay for them in the next 2 years. And what's going to happen? Are they still going to continue to be property of the state, of the enterprise that they broke off from? The rents are inflexible. For example, the Cooperativa La Casona, the restaurant across from Foxa, it's a huge building, and they're paying on basically on square meters, and so they're paying 4,000 CUCs a month just in rent, and so there is this inflexibility of adjusting to the particular conditions of each. The centralized approval process is horrible at this point. Any new cooperative has to be approved by the Council of Ministers after receiving the approval of the corresponding ministry. Sometimes it just gets stuck there because there are some ministries that are not approving, and therefore thus elevating to a higher level the proposal. the lack of training programs and business services, and the question of financing, which we already addressed and I don't want to get into. Constraints that exist. The grassroots cooperatives, I spoke about that already, only can come from allowable TCP activities, and the 201 allowable activities have not changed in over 2 years, and there's this thing of what's going to happen with the professionals. The access to external markets and investment capital is a constraint. The double currency and the multiple exchange rate, which affects the state sector more than the private and the cooperative sector. The lack of second and third tier cooperatives, the lack of cooperative federations, except for ANAP, which is basically a federation of the agricultural cooperatives, and it works both as a federation as an institute. It has its mixed function of representing the state and also representing the cooperatives. The lack of a cooperative institute, it makes this difficult because whoever represents the cooperatives is also representing the state. There is a lack of enabling legislation and public policies. To begin with, non-agricultural cooperatives are not allowed in the Cuban Constitution. So that's just the beginning. And there is really a need for networking, for cooperative movement worldwide that can be an ally to this process. And this is the report of the National Cooperative Business Association after its trip to Cuba last July. And now they have formed formerly the Cuba Cooperative Working Group, and they are really moving forward this agenda here. And so the new cooperatives in Cuba's economic strategy. I think to begin with, there are definitely TCP limitations. I'm sure Ted's going to talk about this, to operate and to grow. But there's also a bias in favor of this Horatio Alger story, right? That these private workers are the heroic individuals who are going to create successful business and bring us into the future. In fact, I think that the new cooperatives are a lot closer to those elements that will be part of Cuba's emerging small and medium enterprise system. Because to begin with, the basic tenet is this phrase, socialism is social property of the fundamental means of production. And cooperatives, while in the United States is a debate whether they're private or public, in Cuba it's clearly a social form of property. And you can expect a lot more induced non-agricultural cooperatives as Cuba trims its very big and heavy public sector, public administration sector. And you really don't have a choice. When you release thousands of units from the state sector, you can only do two things. You can sell it to the highest bidder, or you could turn it over to its workers. Well, sell it to a high bidder, and that's what happened in Eastern Europe. That's experienced here. You're just basically converting this whole sector into a capitalist sector, and that's not the intention of the country. And finally, there's pressure from below to expand the grassroots cooperatives, which will make a difference. Finally, can Cuba's co-ops become an element of sustainable development? I think so. And I think it can be really part of a social and solidary economy in which the state sector and the private sector and the public administration all have its roles. But definitely, as we move into a diversification of our property and management matrix, a cooperative is definitely going to be a major player in this. Thank you very much.
All right, while they're getting my slides up here, let me thank Ted Pacon for the invitation. It's an honor to be here with so many colleagues from recent vintage and from vintage from the 90s, from when I did some of my research in Cuba. I wanted to also thank Wayne Smith, who's here. When I was a graduate student at Tulane University many moons ago, he gave me some of the seed money from Johns Hopkins, where I first went to Cuba to start some of the research. This was in 1999, I think. So thank you for that. In our book that Arch Ritter and I wrote together, Entrepreneurial Cuba, we do have a chapter on cooperatives, but your presentation is a bit more fresh in terms of the things that are happening right now. I learned a lot. So, and some of what you said, as you did say, will help us, will kind of serve as background for my presentation, especially in terms of opportunities within Cuba, but also the obstacles within Cuba. So I won't repeat, but I may just nod in your direction to say, footnote, Rafael. What I'd like to do, I guess, is someone helping to get my slides up when that comes up. What I'm going to do, and I rarely do this, but as a kind of a way of introducing the topic and also extending my thanks to a couple people, I want to read the opening page of our book, a paragraph from the opening page. Prior to 2010, serious study of this sector, the sector of self-employment or micro-enterprise, was taboo because state policies had consistently stigmatized it as illegitimate and banished it to the shadows. The title of the dissertation that Richard mentioned was Condemned to Informality. Even since 2010, small private enterprise has been relatively underanalyzed within Cuba, a trend partly remedied by the important work of Omar Eberlini Perez Villanueva and Pavel Vidal Alejandro, as well as Juan Triana. So it's also an honor to be here sharing the panels and the room with two of those three economists who've done pioneering work from within Cuba on this same sector. Elsewhere, the earliest and most rigorous work on the subject is easily that of Cuban-American economist Jorge Perez Lopez, who, in fact, was also here this morning. He wrote a book in 1995, 20 years ago, and that book was titled Cuba's Second Economy, From Behind the Scenes to Center Stage. He was being optimistic back in 1995. That book set a high bar for those who might follow him. In the 10 years between 95 and 2005, however, public policy became increasingly antagonistic toward microenterprise and pushed self-employment, known as trabajo por cuenta propia in Cuba, back behind the scenes once again. And it was essentially eviscerated or extinct by 2005. But then the events that have unfolded since 2006, both in Cuba and the United States, have changed things. I also wanted to give a shout-out to Joe Scarpacci, Richard Feinberg, and Phil Peters. Their work has been an exemplary model for its rich ethnographic reportage and its original dispassionate analysis of Cuba's now reemerging private sector. So I guess they're working on my slides here. So what I'll do is I'll just dive right in. The title of my talk today is Enterprise in Cuba, Citizen Empowerment, State Abandonment, or U.S. business opportunity. And I use those three terms because there's a kind of a question mark as to what's happening here, and Richard referred to this at the beginning. Is the Cuban government brushing the crumbs of the economy off the table so that, you know, the Cuban people can live off of them, or is it really partnering with or unleashing the power and the potential of Cuban entrepreneurs? And that question, I think, is still open because if you look at those 201 private sector occupations, which are the same occupations as Rafael mentioned that you can do as a cooperative, there are a handful, and I'll refer to some of those in a second, and John will present on one of those handful, that are truly innovative, modern. We heard before about competitiveness and technology from one of the earlier speakers. Those fit the bill, but the vast majority are survival. So is the state just abandoning people to their own fate? Remember, the you know, this could be seen as economic freedom, but it also could be state abandonment. That's why I use the term state abandonment. Remember, trabajo por cuenta propia could be translated as on your own-ism. You are on your own. Good luck, right? Any luck with getting my slides running? Maybe I'd have to open it up here. No. Hello, is anyone out there? Well, let me start with this then, and maybe someone will come and show the bells and the whistles of the presentation. 1 minute. Okay, great. When Arch and I did the research over the last 15 years for this book, we often heard two expressions from Cuban entrepreneurs that tried to tell us their situation, their struggles, and kind of their philosophy. The first expression was, el ojo del amo engorda el caballo. Thank you. We should go on the road here, right? And the second expression is, el que tenga tienda,
que la tienda.
Y si no,
que la venda.
Yeah, muy bien. Okay. So if you need the translation, the eye of the owner fattens the horse, and whoever has a store should tend to the store, and if not, then sell the damn thing, right? And so this is the popular wisdom that we heard from Cuban entrepreneurs who have essentially said, you know, hey, I'm trying to run a business, and I know as closer I am to the horse of the business, the horse is going to get fat. But if the business is kind of run by a bunch of people who don't really have incentives, then that horse may end up skinny. Rafael Hernandez, the other Rafael, said to me many years ago when I was a student at Tulane University, kind of trying to describe the Cuban economy and the system of incentives, he said, well, in Cuba we have this kind of bizarre system where we pretend to work and the government pretends to pay us. And so that's another way of capturing this same dilemma about the skinny horse and the fat horse who will appear on your screen any second. But basically, the picture that I have up or had up, the skinny horse is eating grass. The fat horse is running. And so it's not just the fact of, you know, what happens to the horse, but what the horse does. How then can you incentivize productivity, activity, versus just mere elements or activities that are centered around survival? And if you review the 201 occupations, Richard, in a white paper he wrote at Brookings a year and a half ago, has a list. We also have the list in our book. You'll see that a number of them, actually a lot of them, are medieval in their orientation and about survival. Raúl's reforms. Raúl's reforms are centered around the a kind of a dilemma or a balance maybe between ambition, prisa, and caution, pausa. Okay, great. So here's our horse or our horses. Okay, and you see the active and the passive, the fat and the skinny.
That's a pregnant horse. That's good too.
Hey, they're growing the population. That's, you know, more mouths to feed, more economic activity, right? I'm a proud father of an 8-month-old son, so don't be down on pregnancy, all right? So so here's kind of a hit list of my favorite kind of warring expressions or phrases in Cuba today. Prisa and pausa that I already mentioned. The one that I want to focus most of my attention on is one that was brought to my attention by Tomás Bilbao and Carlos Rodriguez of the Cuba Study Group. Last year, we partnered with them at the Association for the Study of the Cuban Economy, and we hosted five female entrepreneurs to speak and tell us about their struggles and experiences. And when I was setting up the program, I said, so, dime los nombres de estas cuentapropistas. Tell me the names of these self-employed workers. And Tomás shot back at me very quickly. Well, first of all, they do not want to be identified or introduced as cuentapropistas. They are, and they call themselves, emprendedoras. Why? Because cuentapropista is an idea of survival. It's a government kind of control and limited framework definition, whereas entrepreneur or emprendedora highlights ingenuity, resourcefulness, and market savvy, and that is what they were about. Granted, there are many people in the Cuban economy who are on their own and surviving, but these five women are clearly see themselves as something different and wanted to be presented and understood that way. A couple other words that are kind of between how we frame this series of reforms or updating, and those are indicative of this kind of balance between ambition and caution. We've already seen these numbers, so this kind of points to the plateauing effect of a big jump in 2010, and then slow growth in the numbers of self-employed workers over the past 3 years. This number is a little higher if you add 2014 and the very beginnings of 2015. We're still just shy of 500,000 workers. Remember, 20% of those workers, roughly 100,000 people, are actually people who work for other businesses. They have licenses, basically the same license, but their license is as a contractor or an employee of a business that's run by someone else. So that doesn't mean that there are 500,000 legal entrepreneurs. There's about 400,000, and 100,000 work for them. But the phraseology at the bottom is very important. And this is from the top down, Raul has sent the message repeatedly of a need to change our, he includes himself in this mentality. He uses the word at the bottom, quite a few of us have these biases. We need to facilitate and end the stigma and prejudice and even the demonization. I really think that he was talking obliquely about his big brother, because his big brother was the one who was largely leading the way in the ideological stigmatization of that kind of mal necesario back in the 1990s. Here is just a balance sheet of some of the steps forward, qualitative changes and some quantitative changes in self-employment. Licenses are easy to get now. They used to be a bureaucratic nightmare. They're issued pretty quickly. There's a wider array going from about 170 to now 201 occupations. It's still a number. It's still limited, but it's grown. Tax policy is better, especially if you use lots of inputs. You need, you know, have value added, especially the restaurants. They can deduct a greater percentage of their expenses before paying their taxes. And since 1968, the first time Cubans can actually employ private sector can employ other Cubans. So those are all, I would say, qualitative steps forward, and quantitative steps forward. But I would say that the onerous and frustrating obstacles are still blocking greater development. We've heard about some of these before. I mentioned the fact that many of these things are not entrepreneurial. They're more medieval and survival oriented. Just a quick quote from Julia Cook, who published an article in the New York Times about a year ago. She said, "A Cuban can go into business as a party clown, but not a lawyer." Sorry to the lawyers in the audience. "She can open up a bar, but not a private clinic." Sorry to the doctors in the audience. So here we have a clear division between service, kind of crumb-oriented activity, the crumbs off the table, versus productive and innovative activity. We will hear a little bit more about those when we hear from John. And then there's the list. You know, the list could have been a negative list. It's a positive list. But a positive list is actually a negative thing, because it tells people only what they can do. It doesn't leave it open to them. Okay? Now we have Obama, and I'll close. Given that I have the 2 minutes, this should be just right. I'll close with the pivot of Obama. And on this slide, I simply wanted to highlight the element of the pivot, which I describe as a shift, moving from a failed policy of trying to destabilize Cuba and its government through isolating and impoverishing it and its people. The new policy is exactly the shift, is the opposite, is a 180-degree shift, although the administration doesn't have total control over our policy, thanks to Helms-Burton. Empowerment through engagement and making Cubans more prosperous. There's really a two-track thing going on here. Now, those of you who studied Cuba in the 90s will probably remember track two. This is very different from track two, right? This is the two-track policy of reaching out to the Cuban people, the POC, and also engaging with the Cuban government, the GOC. If you remember Obama's first words in his speech on December 17th, "Today, the United States is changing its relationship with the people of Cuba." That phrase was not an accident. So the idea is to reach out and empower individual entrepreneurs. But there's a sticking point here in the discussions between Vidal and Jacobson. Obviously, we don't have an embassy open yet because it's very technically difficult, but also the United States wants to engage the Cuban people in certain ways that the Cuban government is not comfortable with. But still, they're engaging on a two-track system here, with the Cuban government trying to reestablish relations with it in order to incentivize the government to deepen its reforms. There's a question about regime change lurking in the background. Obama clearly stated at the Summit of the Americas that the United States is not in the business of regime change. Well, there's people in Congress who seem to disagree with Obama, and that's still the law of the land as frozen in Helms-Burton. So my advice to the U.S. Policymakers in this is, eschew any Trojan horse approach to entrepreneurial engagement that seeks to empower the Cuban people by undermining the Cuban government. My last slide here brings us to a win-win-win-win situation, and this is the situation of Airbnb. I'm holding in my hand there, I took a picture of it, of the full-page ad that canvassed many newspapers in the United States on, I think it was April 3rd or so, and it's the Sunday newspaper. And this ad says, "One giant leap for man's kindness. The doors to 1,000 real Cuban homes are now open to you." I highlight this just as a quick way of saying, what did the new Obama pivot specifically allow and provide in terms of support for entrepreneurship in Cuba? Airbnb is the best case example because Obama's pivot legalized purchasing services from the private sector in Cuba. But how do you purchase a service from a private sector in Cuba if you're in the United States? Well, Cubans have 20 years of experience with B&B, but do they have the air? They're getting the air very slowly with the slow internet connections that they have and the expensive ones, but the Airbnb engaged Cuban government, the U.S. government, and Cuban entrepreneurs to make this system work. They develop a workaround, so it's a win for the entrepreneur, more money directly into their pockets. It's a win for the U.S. consumer who can stay in a private home in Cuba. Authentic experience, a real Cuban home, as the ad says. But also the Cuban government needs now to collaborate. There's an incentive for it to collaborate with the private sector because they're swamped by tourists. They don't have enough rooms. And this is they're actually legalizing and permitting tour groups to come through to contract out and work together with Paladares, with Bed and Breakfasts, and other people. So this is kind of an element that highlights some of the potential, and we'll hear more about that potential coming to its fruition in one example from John McIntyre. Thank you very much.
Well, I am going to pick up on some of the points that both Rafael and Ted mentioned on professional services as well as cooperatives. But first, again, let me thank Brookings, Richard, Ted, et cetera, for this opportunity. And then I'm going to dive into one particular field of activity, one license, which is, I think, the one you were trying to come up with, which is computer programming. So, first, though, just on the big picture, again, you've heard a little bit about this, but I'll try to put it in some context. Back to the list of 201 licenses that are available. You can say there's 3 or 5 or 8, but there's less than 10 which are professional services. And put that in the context of a highly educated, you know, highly trained society and the amount of investment in human capital that the Cuban state has put into it, it's just a very strange situation. And just to put this in a little bit of context, and I'm not going to take this comparison too far, but, you know, Israel is a state of 7 million people versus Cuba's 11. And if you look at the education, literacy, and health indicators of Israel versus Cuba, they're identical. They are identical in terms of years of schooling, literacy, everything. And obviously Israel is a unique case. And again, I'm not going to take the comparison too far, but just to state the fact that, you know, Israel's economy is 10 times the size of Cuba's. And they lead with technology, with biotech, with pharmaceuticals, et cetera, all things which actually Cuba is pretty good at. But right now it's restricted in its growth to what's being done in the state sector. And obviously the government is restricted in terms of resources, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, just make that general point. So back to the professional services, the less than 10. 3, I think, are exportable, being accounting services. And, of course, accountants in Cuba don't work with international accounting standards, so that's something that's probably not going to be a big issue or a big source of activity in the near term. I think long term it will be. You know, photography is a niche business. So you come down to number 103 on the list of 201. You have it as 104, but I have the original list. It's 103. I knew he was going to look, which is computer programming. So it's legal in Cuba. It's exportable to the U.S. under the new rules as a service. There's huge demand, both in the U.S. and elsewhere. And guess what? The Cubans are world-class at it. They are, from an early age, those that score high in math are tracked to certain schools, the Escuela Tecnologías, for 10th, 11th, 12th grades. Then they go to USI, which is a world-class institution, and other forms of training. And I'm told that there's actually a high percentage of actual programmers, of coders, versus other computer science fields like network engineers, system engineers, et cetera, because those that infrastructure isn't big in Cuba. So a disproportionate number of those who are steered through this track end up as coders. So you're a coder now in Cuba, and you're looking at potentially great opportunities. Or what are your options in terms of being employed and you know, and having a fulfilling work experience? I mean, obviously, you know, many are in the public sector, working at state companies. USI contracts a number of them to work on very important projects. And what's the big advantage of being in that situation is, in addition to a decent wage, which actually the wages are going up for programmers in the public sector. I mean, they're paying as much as, you know, 90, 100 kooks a month now, which is quite a bit higher than other comparable professions. But you have access to the Internet, right, to do both the job you're supposed to be doing and potentially other jobs. But you have steady access to the Internet in most cases, which is a very big deal. So you take a chance and leave the state sector and get your quintuple piece of license to be a computer programmer. You may earn more money. Certainly some are earning significantly more than the number I just mentioned. But the question is, you know, what is your access to the Internet? I mean, Cubans have gotten very, very good at working offline. I know programmers, you know, through Cuba Emprende, about 5% of our graduates are programmers. We know some that are already working for companies in Miami. And what they do, well, they do various things, but most of their work is done offline, and either then it's downloaded to a hard drive or a flash drive and you know, transported to where it needs to go, or they have an Ictexa landline, and they're using a dial-up modem, which you know, they don't use it all day. They get what they need to do in the morning, download it, they work all day offline, and then they push it back, you know, through a modem back to Miami or wherever else. But still, it's fraught with that risk in terms of, you know, losing your access. And also the quintuple piece of license for a computer programmer is actually one of the worst from a taxation point of view. I think you can only deduct 10% of your costs. It's at the bottom of the list of that. And, of course, it faces all the other same challenges that other license holders has, which scaling is very difficult. You know, more than five employees, you get, the labor taxes kick in, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there are some decent size companies, but it's an awkward situation where you have one or two licenses and the contractors and so on. So less than ideal. So what could be done? I mean, what's a favorable scenario for the outlook? I mean, this is where I get to the cooperative situation. And a general comment on professional service cooperatives. I'm only aware of one. And Rafael, please correct me, but there's a consultancy that in fact helps other cooperatives get started.
There's four now.
There's four?
And two functioning.
Okay, two functioning. Okay. But still, it gets back to the same point. All these educated people who only have, you know, several, a couple of licenses that they can and to take advantage of, and programming would be, I think, adapt itself very well to cooperative structure. But the question is, will the approvals be forthcoming to allow this to happen? I was encouraged. I didn't know about the announcements yesterday. I think Omar referenced, I'm not sure, or maybe Juan, about being able to contract outside labor now for 12 months and the tax holiday going up 6 months. I mean, that's all great to continue to tinker with the cooperative structure. But this, I think, is going to be key for an ecosystem to develop, and that Cuba can take its place, you know, as it should, I think, in a among, you know, societies which can actually harness the talent that you know, that and the investment that's been put into its people. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Three terrific presentations, all very complimentary. Ted, how much time do we have for this panel now? We started a little bit late, we started a little bit late, so maybe we'll grab a few extra minutes. But we are running up against the lunch time. Let me throw the first question on the table, then we'll open it up. So the Cuban government has been saying they want the embargo lifted. They want the embargo lifted, but President Obama put on the table a major opening from the embargo, in which he said U.S. companies could import and export with the non-state sector, that is to say with cooperatives and with the quintopropistas. Yet, to my knowledge, with maybe one or two small exceptions of the sorts that have been mentioned here, that process announced at the beginning of this year has not yet opened up. And we've talked about all the constraints on co-ops and private sector, one major one of which was inputs. And that's precisely the offer that's on the table. Buy from U.S. firms. What are the obstacles that need to be removed in order for Cuba, for the quintopropistas, for the co-ops, to take advantage of the Obama offer that's on the table?
Why don't you start it, then?
Well, the state holds a very rigid monopoly over the foreign sector in general. So imports, exports, financing is totally controlled, and there it seems to be no tendency right now to decentralize access to this. So this is a major obstacle from the Cuban side. There is no, I haven't heard that there is any movement in that direction. It could be also, there could be movement as a result of some advancement in the normalization of relations with Cuba, with the United States. But right now, that is a major obstacle. And the sector that you're talking about, I know for a fact that the Minister of Communications has a stack of applications to form cooperatives in the information sector. And the problem is that when you export those services, either internally to foreign or joint ventures, or externally to a foreign client, you are basically breaking that monopoly. And that, I think, is what's holding it back. Now the new announcements, they will be able to sell or purchase those products within Cuba. So a state enterprise or a joint venture could do it. But at this point, I think that that's one of the biggest obstacles.
Any other comments on that?
I mean, Rafael really captured it. I call that the autobloqueo. Sometimes it's referred to that as the internal restrictions. There was a really instructive case in late 2013 of the Cuban government cracking down on some of the creative interpretations that some of the quintapropistas had made of their licenses. So people who had licenses to be seamstresses and tailors were actually importing through mules from Ecuador and Miami clothing and then setting up all across the island of Cuba little boutiques on every street corner in the portales of Cuba, and they were reselling that imported clothing. That clothing was of better quality, it was more variety, it was better price than the monopoly retail that the Cuban government has, and the Cuban government didn't like that. And so instead of trying to figure out how can we recognize this so it provides goods and services at a good price, at a good quality, and a good variety, it closed them all down. Now, it closed them all down. It said, like in September or October, hey, this is not in your license, that you're being a little bit too creative. And it gave them until December to liquidate their goods. But I've heard that what they've done essentially is that now they just use catalogs. And so they still do this. They still pay off people at the customs, and they just circulate catalogs, and then people can buy the clothing that way. The same thing happened with a very inventive interpretation of a license for children's entertainment. People set up 3D movie theaters in their homes. This was very successful, and the Cuban government said, this is not included in your license, and they closed down all of the showings of Avatar in Cuba. I'm sure they still survive in one way or another. So this is a big issue, and this brings us back to, I think, the issue of political will that was raised before.
Thanks. My own view, by the way, is that the executive branch could undertake a second round of economic liberalization, but I don't see them doing that until what they've already proposed, what's already on the table, actually goes into effect. So we need to see to what extent the offer that's already on the table is permitted in the Cuban context before I think you'd like you to see a second round of carving away exceptions to the embargo. All right, we have time for why don't we do this, Ted, since we've got a tight time constraint. I'll take three or four questions at once, and then the panel can respond to those questions that they find most interesting as a way to wrap it up. Let's see how far back we can go. Who's the farthest back there? The woman here on the... Yes, you please. Could you stand up and identify yourself?
And my question is, to what extent is brain drain a challenge for Cuba's economic development? I believe, you know, in the 90s and maybe after that, it was seen as, you know, there was a lot of flight of talent. But now I'm told by Cubans and others that some are returning, whether to open businesses or to invest or to engage in other activities. Well, I have other questions, but I'll leave it
at that.
That's
great. Okay. Thank you. Do I see the hand of a leading Cuban scholar to whom we all must bend down and recognize his longstanding expertise as well as a high moral character. Phil Brenner.
Where is he?
Right here.
So Ted Henkin alluded, Philip Brenner, American University. Ted Henkin alluded to one of the issues that faces the Cuban government and leads to a paradox, and that is corruption. The one of the reasons for clamping down on some of these private dealings is to avoid corruption, yet it paradoxically opens up the possibility for corruption. Can you speak to the problem of corruption? Is there evidence that the way in which the Cuban system is now operating with cooperatives is leading to payoffs so that people can get licenses, so that they can skirt the system?
Okay, one or two more questions about the two people, in the two hands in the back, and that'll be our four questions. Please identify yourselves.
Yes, Frank Fletcher, Daniel Morgan Academy. In terms of the housing situation, it was mentioned previously that about 4 million houses needed to be rehabilitated. I don't see that solution coming from foreign investment. I can't see, given the minimal Cuban income, that anyone would want to or could own apartment buildings or things. The ability of people to pay rent is just not there. But I don't know what could be done in that regard, but it's a tremendous problem. Rehabilitation of existing housing or the construction of new housing.
Okay, of course, if you travel around Cuba today, you will see already a lot of remodeling going on by the very owners themselves of the properties, very often with money that's come from abroad, that is to say remittances, which may simply be donations or may be under the table forms of investment.
Yes. Hi, Wendy Lures from
the
Foundation for Civil Society and Beyond Conflict. What role is the European Union and the Europeans playing?
Okay. All right. That's four broad questions. You don't have to tackle every one of them, but maybe if each panelist would take one or two of those questions, then we'll wrap it up. Start with Raphael.
Okay. In terms of the brain drain, I think that after 2013, as was noted here, in January, the immigration law was passed, and it allows Cubans to stay abroad for a two-year period, after which they must return in order to renew their passport. But they do not lose their properties. They do not lose any of their benefits as Cuban residents. So now you have people that are actually residing in two places. They have residency abroad and they have residency in Cuba. This allows for this reversal of brain drain. I think that the Chinese and others have shown that the people that left in a certain period of time can return with greater skills and greater knowledge, and this becomes a possibility and in some cases a reality, as in the case of people coming back from Spain with a small amount. 20,000 euros will not get you much very far in Spain, but that will allow you to make a significant investment in Cuba. So I think that that's the brain drain can be reversed. Secondly, in terms of corruption, what we're seeing most is the evasion of taxes, as was mentioned here, and also obtaining supplies in the black market because of the huge limitations in the wholesale. But in terms of paying off people, there's probably some in terms of inspectors, health inspectors and people like that. But generally, the licenses, as was mentioned here, are being issued rather expediently. And finally, in terms of housing, you're right, Richard, that the issue right now is the availability of building materials, which is there's a lot of constraints in that, and that if there was a greater availability, there will be a lot more owners that are repairing their own homes.
Let me add really quickly to the question on brain drain. Sometimes this is referred to as el robo de cerebros, more kind of propagandistically, but there is a U.S. policy that tries to incentivize that for doctors. You could also call it brain waste, right? And if you don't give people opportunity, you're wasting that talent. We've talked a lot about that kind of contradiction of training people really well, educating them for free, and then straitjacketing them. So that is an issue. I heard at Lhasa just a few days ago in Puerto Rico a great presentation by a political scientist, sociologist, Antonio Aja from Cuba, on the demographic transition and the problems that Cuba faces. Of course, they have an aging population, and they also have very high rates of immigration, people leaving the country. Although it is true, and he did point out, that Cuba's escape hatch has now become a revolving door. And that does mean that, you know, the future you can bet on or depend on people going abroad and bringing back skill, know-how, and money to invest in businesses, et cetera. The issue of corruption, this is a very practical one, but also a kind of a theoretical one, in that it partly is a result of the institutional structure of opportunities and also constraints. If you're a Cuban entrepreneur or if you're a Cuban lawmaker, one philosophy is to make very strict laws and make lots of laws, and that's what they have done, but that really creates law evasion. So what really needs to happen is a kind of a reform so that there are fewer but well-enforced and logical, justifiable regulations. The last thing I'll mention is the import-export issue that wasn't really raised, but I think it's an important one. On the U.S. side, and this speaks to your question, Richard, I've heard a number of U.S. diplomats say very clearly that the United States would be open to sending or allowing the export of materials to Cuba, even through, if they were forced to use all import, a very, very appropriately named organization, since they import everything, as long as they got certification that all import, the final customer was the private sector. So the United States government seems to be bending over backward to saying, we want to work with you, knocking on the door, but that monopoly on the foreign trade is a big one.
John? Yeah, just on the same first two topics, I think I'll leave the other two to you, Richard. But no, just on the brain drain, I agree with the points that were made. I just go back to the fact that, you know, opportunity for, in the end, Cuba's going to be a service-based economy, and getting greater opportunities for trained, skilled people in the services is going to be key to keeping them there. They may be coming back, but the question is, are they just coming back, you know, not to work, and their primary business is offshore. They're just coming back to see family and to enjoy Cuba. So, again, I go back to the point of scalable businesses, which, you know, cooperatives seem to be the solution to that, and broader licensing categories for professionals are going to be ultimately, I think, the key towards keeping a lot of, you know, the most highly trained people in Cuba. You know, on the corruption issue, just at the micro level, you know, and we see this with Cuba Emprende graduates. I mean, the risk of the system now is that the individual license holder faces a set of taxation rules that, if strictly speaking, were abided by, most of them, you know, would be paying more in taxes than they're making. You know, there was a reference earlier to 60% underreporting. I'm surprised it's only 60%. I think it's probably higher. But so the taxation system then is perverse, and that lends itself to selective enforcement, right? So you have, as tax collectors come around and try to look at the books of quintropopistas, it just puts a lot of arbitrary authority in the hands of tax collectors, and that's just a very dangerous situation, you know, for all sides.
Okay. On the corruption side, in addition to the points of burdensome rules that inevitably produce evasion, you have the two fundamental root causes of corruption in Cuba, I would say. One is extremely low wages, and the other is generalized lack of transparency. Those are your two fundamental root causes that need to be addressed over the long run, I would say. The other point on barriers to why the Obama offer has not yet, which would solve so many of the problems we've talked about in the cooperative and quintropopista sector, I think one missing piece of it is finance. Who might provide the finance, and what sort of financial trade credit guarantees might be available? And I think that's a piece that I would suggest the U.S. and the Cuban government put on the table for their future round of discussions. Finally, Wendy Lohr's question about the role of the EU, maybe just very briefly. First, of course, you have investments, direct investments from the European Union, many of them dating from the 1990s, and I expect you'll have another wave now with the new opportunities on the table. You also have the upcoming Paris Club discussions to deal with previous existing commercial debts, which need to be dealt with. And the Paris Club, which is mainly Europeans, have indicated they would be interested in focusing on. And then finally, as you know very well, the ongoing discussions about the common position and political and human rights issues that are part of that ongoing discussion. Then finally, of course, the EU as a group and then individual countries do have small but in some cases very interesting bilateral foreign assistance programs, technical assistance programs in a range of areas. And that I think with the willingness of the Cuban government could be scaled up, and perhaps you could have co-financing with CAF and with others to take some of those interesting projects and take them to the next level. So with that, Ted, I think we can wrap up a very successful panel. Thank you all very much.
Well, thank you for joining us for the final panel of this fantastic conference. It's been very enjoyable to hear all the conversations so far, and I think we're looking forward to ending on a high note here. My name is Harold Trinkunas. I direct the Latin America Initiative and the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, and it's my pleasure to be chairing this panel today on the prospects for foreign direct investment in Cuba, the new setting. So I think just to put things in perspective, as we heard earlier today, Cuba really has fairly large investment needs moving forward to address a number of the shortfalls that have been identified in this conference. And there's some limits to its ability to meet these shortfalls. We heard something about the limits to state revenues and therefore the state's ability to address infrastructure needs. We heard something about the limits of the ability of multilaterals to be part of the solution, both because of the issues raised by Cuba's membership or lack thereof in certain institutions, also just the limits of the available capital in multilaterals, limits on access to global financial sort of bank lending for Cuba due to some questions about its past debt obligations. So given that scenario, I think when you look at the remaining options, foreign direct investment is really a major part of the solution. And in fact, the foreign direct investment would probably have to occur on a fairly significant scale and be sustained across quite a period of time to address some of the issues that have been raised so far today with regards to Cuba. Obviously, the U.S.-Cuba rapprochement, a major part of the reason why we're all here today to discuss these issues, has opened the door for a wider, at least exploration of the issues associated with FDI, and in fact, foreign direct investment is very much part of the discussion by international companies as well as in part, very much part of the thinking of some in the United States. Of course, we should all be wary of any irrational exuberance as we all look at the future. I think this panel we have here today is going to help us take a very measured and sober and thoughtful look at the issues facing the prospects for a large-scale increase in foreign direct investment in Cuba. There's a number of issues that obviously will be have to address by the Cuban state, by the Cuban people, by foreign investors as they look at the evolution of the Cuban economy. And this includes, of course, issues associated with the legal framework for investments and for dispute resolution. It includes issues associated with the approval process for foreign direct investment and how that can be facilitated. There's labor market issues. There's productivity issues. Currency, the possibility of repatriation of profits, the issues associated with past disputes over property claims, and many, many others. And I think the panel that we have for you here today is really will do a wonderful job of helping us to start thinking about these issues. And I'd like to introduce them in order. First, Professor Omar Everleni from the University of Havana. He has taught and lectured at a number of universities, not only in Cuba, but across the globe. And he's also an extremely prolific author on the Cuban economy and international economics, including a co-author of the Cuban economy at the start of the 21st century with Jorge Dominguez and other authors. So he'll lead us off. He'll be followed by José María Vinales, who will be he's a partner and director of international operations at the Lupicino International Law Firm, with extensive experience in corporate project finance, working with major international companies, with a good deal of experience also in Cuba as a columnist for Cuba Económica and a monthly contributor for Legal Today. He will be followed by Mark Entwistle. Mark is the founding partner of Acasta Capital, who has been working on Cuban affairs and on business in Cuba continuously for 22 years in a number of different roles associated with Acasta Capital, a merchant bank based in Toronto. In the past, he was also ambassador of Cuba from 1993 to 1997, so really somebody with very deep experience looking at Cuban issues from the outside. And the final discussant will be Augusto Maxwell, who's the chair of Ackerman's Cuba practice, extensive experience on issues related to the U.S. embargo on Cuba, particularly with respect to Treasury Department's OFAC, traveled extensively in Cuba, and also has a great good deal of experience teaching about Cuba as a lecturer of law at the Columbia University School of Law. So without much further ado, if I could ask Omar to lead us off. Omar, por favor.
Okay, thank you very much to Brookings and particularly to Ted and all the participants here for providing us the opportunity to express our opinions about what's going on in Cuba with regard to direct foreign investment. I'm speaking on behalf of the University of Havana, not on behalf of the Ministry of Foreign Investment. So there's some things that also I would like responses or answers about some things, but for 10 years I've been asking. I've done my doctorate in foreign investment in Cuba, and so I have an idea, the good idea of the process from an academic point of view. What's been put on the table here, looking at the morning panels, Cuba has structural problems, and therefore, if there are structural problems, there has to be structural trends. If there's structural trends, there has to be investment. That is enough investment. However, there's not enough with the growth rate, which is around 5 or so percent. Foreign investment must, over the next years, has to play not a complementary role, as people you would say in the past, but it has to be fundamental with regard to investment in the country and the people. This is a very different level. They talk about relaunching foreign investment, but we forget that Cuba had foreign investment since 1992 on, and it's been growing. And what we also forget is more than 80% of the exports that come from Cuba are done by foreign companies. It's not that we're just beginning, starting from zero with a foreign investment. We have to recall, and in some of the conferences, they say to me, Law 118 doesn't have so many. It's not that different from 177. But who said that Law 177 is a bad law? Law 77, there's a lot of discretion available. What 118, Law 18 has clarified certain activities or certain amounts or certain levels of approval or certain dates, time periods for approval of businesses, but it's a law that's quite broad. What's new, what's novel about it that the Congress, based on the guidelines from the Sixth Party Congress, has clearly said that the vitality of viewing foreign investment as an important component, it's a priority. The special development zone of Mariel, the creation, but what the document says is that we're going to create areas of special areas. It wasn't just Mariel. Mariel is just the first one. There can be others created. But in my view, we can't be ambitious and think about other ones until we consolidate and solidify Mariel. It was created without, no, we're going to have 17 December change things, and that's going to solidify this. There has been a quickening after that day on December 17th. But before that time, there were bills submitted to begin projects that were submitted. There's priorities of the state. I don't agree that the development area of Mariel can turn into a maquila area, an offshore assembly area. I think that's a priority, that it's not. The investments have to be in high technology and in renewable energy. I think there's certain important priorities. China almost has no presence. They're not going to be selling to the. It's what China's just looking for natural resources in Latin America. There's been China has a lots of sales and trade relations with these countries throughout Latin America. And we have to, this what sets China apart. It's not interested. When we talk about the special Mariel special development area or zone, remember this was during a climate where there were several factors that were in play. Cuba had to build a modern container terminal. It had to do it because the port of Havana wasn't enough. It was inadequate. And either we develop old Havana to be a tourist point, and also there were technical problems with the port of Havana. The tunnel didn't allow certain vessels to go through. This all had to be done with money. And there was a credit from Brazil for infrastructure works. We have to remember that an infrastructure work was to create a port and container terminal. But the largest world PCI from Singapore wanted to find a place for transshipment in the Caribbean. The need of Cuba, the money from Brazil and a manager, and that's why how Mariel emerged. It was clear that from the very beginning it could operate without any relationship with the United States, because many of the merchandise from Singapore is from America to Europe. It goes through there. If you remember, since the December 17th, remember, with all the interest of foreign companies, now, since December 17th, there's been greater interest generated, but it's part of the development strategy of Cuba system is to have an important zone, not just any zone, but an area where there's no demands for competition. It's 400-some-hundred square kilometers with a priority, which is the A1 to A11 zone is the priority on this. Everybody's working on it. Because you go to, everybody went to this Mariel special area. Cuba's saying this is the area we got to start working in. It said you can see four derricks and for container loading. And you should see it. Law 118. We could say it's a good law. It hasn't been as dynamic as we hoped it would be after a year after it was enacted, right? It's a bit. In actual, Cuba's interest with Law 118 was to create joint ventures with 100% foreign capital, and all the companies that have come in right now are totally foreign companies. In the past, and this is the way it's been because the state realized with the level of decapitalization that the lack of capital available to the Cuban government, and so to create a new company would be much more expensive, and so it's better to have others. So their proposal that'll be majority capital holder owner of Cuba, the state, but in public services, but in other activities, it's not an impediment. There's no impediment, but any proposal, bid is accepted. But what's being approved right now have to do with tourism and inputs, because of the great demand there is. International tourism is the main thing, and as Juan was saying, 36% increase in April of tourists, of American visitors came about. That's an important figure. I don't know what they want to see in Cuba exactly. They want to see if a. I believe this state is being very pragmatic in its decisions and its approvals. If I was the decision maker, I would go beyond the 300 projects that have been introduced. Five have been approved, but there are 20 that are in the final stage of approval. Let I'll give you a couple of minutes more. These are companies that come mostly from Europe, and these are companies, I don't know if you instances have been in Cuban, or they've been in the final stage, and they're coming back again. I would imagine that they're beating out other companies that could come in, with like Unilever, which has a presence in Maria. And this company had been demand for U.S. property, but so they decided on a modern company in the Mariel zone. There's also important business is being done in the area of leasing. They're not going to sell trucks, but they're going to have a company that's going to have high tonnage trucks to lease out to the companies in Mariel. This is an important role, and there's consultancies for business. So the important thing about Law 118 is it enables the creation of professional service providing industries. And the surveys that have been conducted of all the companies that operate in Cuba, the first question we ask is the employer agency. If you ask me, there shouldn't be employment agency. But the employment agency under Law 118 is different from the prior agency. The employment agency is going to try to pay the worker much more than what was paid before. The law says 80% of what's negotiated with the employer can be kept by the workers themselves. Everybody knows that this it's in national currencies, that's 1 to 10, and the rate of exchange is different. There's a lot of difficulties. But any worker works in is run 8 or 9, 10 than if they worked outside of the Marielito zone, and that's an incentive to want to work there. But there's a lot of difficulties. But now to wrap up, from the legal point of view, it's very important for foreign investments, but there's not enough that there's a law on the books. Cuba has to make a lot more progress in the economic elements if it doesn't have a high growth rate. If it does the dual edge sword of the currency, etc., everything has to come together and a more clear design and not so much discretion in decision making process. Thank you. Once again, I apologize for the time. Each one has 7 minutes.
Without much further ado, Jose Maria.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you to the Brookings Institution and to TED for organizing this event. This event is it's a sign that sometimes imagination can surpass reality. If some months ago someone would have told us that we would be here, talking about Cuba and how to invest in Cuba and sharing our experience in Cuba, they would have said we were crazy. But the reality sometimes surpasses the imagination. I agree with Dr. Omar that we have to take into account, first of all, that Cuba is a planned and socialist economy that has not renounced to its socialist principles after the announcement of Obama on the 17th of December. In October 2011, there were 300 guidelines that were approved by the Socialist Party, by the Congress, the 6th Congress of the Socialist Party. Within these 300 guidelines, some major changes have happened in Cuba. For example, the private market has started. We have seen how the private market has increased from 5% to up to 20-25% by means of the cooperatives and by means of the individual and independent entrepreneurs. Maybe for us this would not be a major change in an economy, but for the Cubans this has been a revolution within a revolution, because Cubans for the first time in 50 years, some of them, they have managed to get money from their own work without being in the payroll of the state. As well, the unification of the two currencies and the protocols that are being taken into account to reach that point. Cuba is the only country in the world where there are two different currencies, and the changes between these two currencies changes. That means that there are 4 or 5 official exchange rates between CUC, peso convertible, and the local peso. And this all gives insecurity to foreign investors when they have to invest in Cuba. Within all these changes, where we have to add the special development zone of Mariel, we can talk about an island within the island, or we can talk about the Cuban Hong Kong. In Mariel, companies can have 100% of the shares of the company. Why are they doing this? For many reasons. One of them is to create a hub in the Caribbean to be able to export to smaller ports the goods that may come from the Panama Channel. Then, as well, they want to create this place where they can attract foreign technology, where they can increase the employment rates of Cuba, and as well they can depend less on the imports. We also have to take into account that Cuba imports twice as much of what they export. So that's one of their priorities as well. The new foreign investment law has been a small change if we compare it to the previous law. But this law has to be seen within the other, within the context of changes that is happening in Cuba since 2011. As well, both the Zona Especial de Desarrollo Mariel and the new investment law, the new foreign investment law, they provide a new tax system which makes things much easier for foreign investors. During the first 8 years, foreign investors would not be paying $1 as tax for the investments and for the results coming out of the investments that they will be carrying on. Obviously, there are things that can be improved. The first one, being a lawyer, is to liberalize the legal sector, of course, and that would be a lot of legal certainty to foreign investors to have independent private lawyers, as we can find in many other places. As well, allowing companies 100% fully owned by foreigners. It is true that within the law it is possible, but then the reality shows us that the Cuban government is reluctant to approve 100% foreign-owned companies in the island. As well, Cuba has one account system. It's like a family. They get their inputs, their cash flows, and then they get the payments they have to honor. Cuba always honors the payments, but they only have one account. So there is a list where the people, they get their number in the list, and depending on when you're in the list, you'll get paid before or after in the time. So that as well has to be changed. But as Dr. Omar may explain us later, it is important to take into account as well that Cuba doesn't have the capacity to honor foreign exchange payments because they don't have enough resources to complete and honor those payments. So they have to get into those. They have that limitation, and that is a limitation as well for private for foreign companies wanting to invest in Cuba. Legal certainty in Cuba is one of the points that most of the foreign investors ask us. Cuba, over the paper, is a country that has legal certainty to foreign investors. First of all, there are 62 bilateral international treaties that have been signed between the Republic of Cuba and 62 countries, including 15 European countries, by means of which any of their nationals and companies investing in Cuba, they will have the right to go to an international investment arbitration in the event there is any problem with the Cuban state. As well, there are many double taxation treaties between European countries and Latin American countries and Cuba to prevent the double taxation. Cuba is as well a signatory of the Geneva and New York Conventions. That means that they have to enforce foreign arbitrations in Cuba. Since the 1960s, Cuba has developed their arbitration system as a method for alternative dispute resolution, because they found that the courts, the magistrates, the judges, they implemented some kind of bourgeois system to resolve disputes. So since the 1960s, Cuba has been very active in arbitration, and the society in general has this experience. As well, the foreign investment law protects any nationalization from any foreign investor, and if there is any nationalization because of a major event, they'll have to compensate the foreign investor. They'll have to give him they'll have to compensate and pay him for his investments. 1 minute. As well, there's protection in the foreign investment law against any extraterritorial effect of any other third country. So sanctions, the U.S. sanctions, would not be applicable for foreign investors in Cuba. And as well, the freedom to repatriate any money, any dividend, any benefit earned in Cuba. I would like also to take into account that according to her 20 years experience in Cuba, we have been assisting European companies to establish in Cuba, and they have already 20 years of experience ahead of any U.S. company. The inconsistency of the sanctions and how the executive power in the United States, they have said that the sanctions, they have no use and have not been effective. And on the other side, the legislative power, having still those regulations still in place against the Republic in Cuba. What they do is to give, what they are doing is that European companies, they are going again to Cuba, and they don't have limitations, as the U.S. companies have, out of those windows that the OFAC has given to American companies. In this sense, the situation of the U.S. companies right now and U.S. investors is like being in a ship where you think that the wind never blows in the correct direction because you do not know to what port you want to go. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jose Maria. I think we'll go to Mark Entwistle next, yeah, please.
Thank you, Harold. I thought what I would do is kind of go up to about 30,000 feet, and I'm very happy to get into weeds and things on all kinds of aspects of foreign investment, but look at maybe, with your permission, three kinds of things. I think we need a slight romp through the history of foreign direct investment in Cuba to truly understand where the Cubans are now, and also just a few words about the kind of profile, if you will, of foreign investment in Cuba, and then some of the defining characteristics in 2015. The reason why I wanted to take just a little bit of your time on the history piece was because, in Cuba, everything is both political, but it's also fundamentally informed by history, even if people don't really quite, realize that it is. And I often the quasi joke with American business people who haven't had the exposure and the experience to Cuba that Jose Maria was talking about, and when they ask for like a single piece of advice, read a history book about the history of Cuba. It's just do that to start, and a lot of what informs, underlies Cuban approaches to public policy decisions are embedded in history. And in terms of foreign investment over the last, say, two decades, I think there's probably three major phases, if I would split them up. The years are not totally specific, but in general, from about roughly 1993 to the late 1990s, after, of course, the collapse of the Soviet Union and Cuba kind of its GDP spiraled, et cetera, as we all know, there's what I would call the Wild West period. And I was there at the time. You cannot imagine all kinds of carpetbagger charlatans, shysters, mom and pop shops, you name it, showed up in Cuba. They formed hundreds of joint ventures. Frankly, the Cubans were at that time struggling to find some kind of life boat or something in the choppy waters that they were in. By the late 1990s and into the 2000s, they had pulled out of that period, of course, and back from the precipice. And in terms of direct foreign investment, they entered into a period of what I broadly call kind of reassertion and reassessment. By reassertion, I mean reasserting kind of a control over the situation. They learned very powerful and painful lessons from that period in the 1990s that not all foreign businessmen are created equal, and they learned the concept of diligence. You have to actually know who you're dealing with. Many of these companies, the foreigners had not a penny in their pocket. They came from some village in Italy or somewhere in Canada to form a pizza dough factory or whatever. And in the early 2000s, what the Cubans did, they shut down hundreds of non-performing joint ventures, cleaned up the landscape. And from that, two things emerged. One, a very strategic and reaches almost an obsession with dealing with large operating partners, companies that are knowable with balance sheets that know their businesses, know what they're doing on the one hand. And during that period of roughly the 2000s, kind of stepping back from foreign investment in general, because it had been such a kind of horrific experience, focusing more on subsidization strategies, relationships with with countries like Brazil, of course, the Bolivarian subsidy of Venezuela, and friendly credit terms from wherever they could get it. Bringing us up to 2014, the new foreign investment law 118, which I think is an important law in the sense that, it, in addition to its provisions, it is a political reassertion again of the importance of the return of Cuba to the global capital markets. I think the Cubans realized that they could not tread water forever, and the future economic development of the country did now require some modus vivendi with direct foreign investment. Interestingly, out of all that mayhem in which of the Wild West period, when all these joint ventures, most of them failed, a few of the iconic poster boy joint ventures that if you were to have a Cuban minister here or somebody who would rhyme off a list of who the top JVs as success stories were, you have in nickel mining, you've got Pernod. They all come from that crazy Wild West period, but they were ones that were done properly and have been tremendously durable and sustainable. And those are companies that have long-term, obviously strategic visions of what to do in Cuba. Very briefly, we often talk about foreign investment as kind of a monolithic idea about foreign investment. What I believe, in fact, there's several faces or maybe even what I would call personalities of foreign investment in Cuba. Sometimes hears the word, the Cuba being kind of opaque or opacity. I don't think even really that's the word that captures Cuba. Cuba has a kind of cohabitation of different realities. So inside what's called foreign investment, you've got sort of multiple players all jumbled around with each other. And it forms a kind of segmenting of the foreign investment scene. You've got what I would call the general, the ground rules are fundamentally the same. It's how you enter the playing field that's a little bit different. So you've got basic law 118. You've got the cartera, which is the long list of 246 foreign investment deals, if you will, that are being put forward. And that forms the kind of what I would call the civil framework of foreign investment. Then you've got the Mariel Special Economic Zone kind of popped over in the corner with where you can have the 100% foreign-owned companies. You can have them in the mainstream economy, too. But it kind of marches to its own drum, and it's got a bit of its own rhythm. And you're already starting to see tensions created between old-fashioned joint ventures in the kind of national economy and companies setting up or perceiving to set up in Mariel. Then you have another very, very specifically Cuban factor, which is a part of the economy, and this is no grand secret, which is run by military companies under a holding company called GAESA, who have the same broad rules of engagement because they are approved by parliament, by the legislative function. But they march their own drum. They tend to be companies that are extremely well-run, very efficient. So foreign investors have this kind of panoply of different portals through which to open into Cuba. Cuba's very segmented. It's segmented on currency grounds. It's segmented on property grounds. And in addition, thanks, it is segmented in a way on foreign investment. Very, very briefly, characteristics, I would say, of Cuba foreign investment in 2015. You've got a little bit of echoes now, post-December 17th of the 1990s. It's not the same. I think three big characteristics. A sense of caution that the Cubans have based on their need for diligence, not to repeat. They want the operating partners. There's that. But they're also, at the same time, no longer ambivalent, which you always had a feeling in past times. They're more committed. for strategic policy reasons. I think the 100% foreign ownership piece is important in that. And there is greater clarity around the rules to a certain extent, although I would argue to a large extent on big ticket investment items, they have not yet been tested, but that will come. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. And turning to our final panelist, Augusto Maxwell.
Great. Thank you so much, Brookings, for inviting me. This is a great experience. I've been involved in Cuba since 2003, and I take pride in having negotiated the first sale of Florida cattle to Cuba. And so I've been around this game a little bit. And obviously, the United States is not allowed to do foreign direct investment, but we've pursued all kinds of business activities that are legal. And with the December 17th announcement, as you can imagine, there was tremendous interest in this country and Miami, where I am from. I'm a proud member of the Cuban-American exile community that has so imposed its will on this process. And another member of that community, Carlos Salavarigas, is here today, who is in charge of the Cuba Study Group that's done a lot of groundbreaking work in Miami trying to point to a different direction and policy. And so when these rules were announced and it was clear there was a new day, Carlos organized a meeting with the Miami Chamber of Commerce to talk about Cuba. What does it mean? What does this new perspective mean? And one of the things that I was struck by was an almost dismissive attitude about the idea that one would invest in Cuba. And folks were very knowledgeable about pointing out all the deficiencies in the Cuban economy and the Cuban law, banking system. And I was struck by that. And so my contribution was to point out that the befuddlement about how to do business in Cuba is unique to us in Miami. And my friends from Canada and Spain and other places have managed quite well to figure out how to do it. And so the burden is now on us as Americans, as Cuban Americans, and those who are interested in moving this thing forward to come up and catch up to speed. And I'm so happy that both Jose Maria, Mark, and Everlini have offered to help me, because I certainly am going to need help. The idea of foreign direct investment from the U.S. into Cuba, of course, is illegal. It's not permitted under the embargo. And one of the things that we have to keep in mind is where the president's authority meets with the text of the regulations. And one example is telecommunications policy. The administration, through its discretion, has made it clear that it wants U.S. companies to invest in the telecom space and help create freedom of communication between the United States and Cuba. The challenge is that there is U.S. law that expressly prohibits U.S. investment in the Cuban telecommunications system. And so as a lawyer, we have to kind of dance around what does the word investment mean, what is the word telecommunications. And one of the things that I was struck by in conversations, public conversations by the administration, was the administration assuring U.S. companies that they, at the end of the day, are the ones that interpret the laws, and they are the ones that enforce the laws, and we're telling you it's not an investment. And any good lawyer for a company knows, well, yeah, but you might not be there tomorrow, right? And the law still will be. And someone else will read it and cause a headache for me. So one of the real challenges in this very unique space is trying to figure out what is allowed by these new licenses, what is within the discretion of the president, and what, in fact, can I as a lawyer sign off on after reviewing the embargo regulations. And I think for the most part, discretion is the better part of valor, and you're not going to see heavy foreign direct investment until you see changes to U.S. law. And as a matter of fact, you have that right now. One of the bills that have been introduced in Congress today would clarify this telecom issue, right? It leaves the embargo in place. We're not talking about lifting the embargo. We're just clarifying that a U.S. telecom company can indeed set up a phone system or pursue an investment on the island.
So that, I think, is really the state of play, if you will, domestically on the U.S. side between what is legal and what is still prescribed by the embargo.
Oh, there you go. If Mark and somebody can turn off the button on the left. So it's
So foreign direct investment by the U.S. is going to go through a very different process. First is going to be the idea of changing the embargo regulations to allow it. That said, there's another set of concerns that I think are going to affect U.S. investment on the island in a way that doesn't affect our friends from Canada and Spain, and that is that there is a large, vociferous Cuban-American community that is looking over the shoulders of all that investment taking place in Cuba. And so that which U.S. investment in China or U.S. investment in Africa or South America doesn't have the same audience or constituency that U.S. investment in Cuba will have, particularly first movers. And so that's going to be a whole other layer that an American company owes to itself to make sure that it does its due diligence, both with government relations and public relations, to properly execute a strategy with respect to Cuba. And I would highlight two issues, or three perhaps, that should be on the radar. One is the issue of claims, right? Confiscated claims. I won't get into the technical conversation, but there's these certified claims that were go to U.S. companies that went through a process. And the other is Cuban national claims by folks like myself who lost a few things in the revolution. As I think about it objectively, sometimes I think, wow, that's a big problem over there. Other times I think about it and I don't think it's going to be a problem at all. But it's something that needs to be vetted. The second significant problem that needs to be thought through is the point that Dr. Everlenny pointed out, which is there's one Cuban employment agency, right? So if I'm an American company, I need to explain that I've hired X number of Cubans and I'm paying the Cuban government $100 and they're only making a fraction of that. Now, there are workarounds and other things that might justify that, but that doesn't look right, and it's going to be difficult for many American companies to think that through. And finally, there's the issue of the Cuban government itself, particular members of the government, and do they really own the business or not? And so those are the kinds of issues that I think are going to be slightly different for American companies moving forward, because they're going to have a domestic audience that some of these other foreign partners don't quite have. And with that, my comments are done.
Well, thank you very much to our panel. Despite what appears to be my ruthless timekeeping, we, in fact, just have 25 minutes left for Q&A, and I know we have a very interested audience. So I think I'm just going to pass directly to Q&A from the audience. Again, please raise your hand, and I'll put you on the list. And if you could wait for the microphone before asking your question, and please identify yourself when you ask your question. So I think I have one here already in the front row. And another one? Third? Okay.
Yes, sir. Hello. It's good? Okay. Rafael Betancourt from Havana Consulting. Mark spoke about greater due diligence on the part of the Cuban government in selecting foreign investment partners now than in the 90s. There's one change, important change in the corporate world between the 90s and now, and that's the importance of corporate social responsibility. And yet I have not seen in any of the new legislation or in the Cuban declarations any mention of corporate social responsibility and how it could be an added contribution of a foreign partner in partnering with Cuba. So I'd like your opinion on that topic.
Okay.
Let's maybe take a round of three questions, and then we'll come back to the panel. And then, so I think there was immediately adjacent to you, and then there was one further back.
David Lewis with Manchester Trade. One question and a quick comment from the previous session. For the lawyers, your interpretation of communications technologies in today's world, media, TV, film, because the tradition is that it's just phone calls, which, of course, used to be landlines. Now it's cellular, which means anything that's floating. So I think that's going to be a challenge. And just a comment on the previous panel. Take Under Secretary Selig to task on questions. We already have various cases of large U.S. companies with allowed sales of goods allowed under the 12, and all of a sudden say, well, listen, you need to pay a customs broker in Havana, like you do in any country in the world. And a customs broker in Havana is a state. So, you know, in order to sell and distribute the 2 million goods of construction material to private citizens, which is allowed, it needs to pass customs. I need to pay $30,000. It's a legitimate amount. It's what it costs. And basically what Commerce says is send us the requests. We may have to look at it and do an interpretation. So that's what this process is going to be, because the easy part is get on a plane and travel. That's easy. The hard part is all these little other areas. So, you know, that's what you have government officials for. They're going to have to look at that case by case and answer.
And then one more here, and then we'll come back to the panel.
Manuel Gomez from Progreso Semanal and a private consultant.
Gomez.
Primarily to our last panelists, but to anyone else who may answer. And I recognize it may be an unfair question because it not may be the expertise of this panel, but would you comment on the chances of the telecom legislation that you mentioned, what the prospects might be?
Okay. And that's that. We have a question on social responsibility, a couple questions on the telecommunications sector and telecommunications law, and a question on the sort of the nuances of the relationship that will have to be resolved as we proceed. So if any of you would like to jump in, we'll just go down the panel and answer. Don't feel the need to answer everything. Just focus on what you'd like to intervene on.
Realmente la ley no especifica.
Well, the law doesn't specify that companies have a social responsibility, but taking into account how businesses are approved in Cuba with the involvement of authorities that deal with the environment, etc., I imagine that even though it is not mentioned in the law where we talk about respect for certain elements that is necessary, I think it will be taken into account. I think it's better to arrive late but to actually get there. And if this is going to, and it's going to help us to know what other companies have gone through, and we're just getting started in Cuba, and I agree with you that it should be there. What I wouldn't be too sure would be that the state would actually forget about this. I think this is something that will be included.
With Dr. Omar, when negotiating the clauses of a joint venture company or getting a business approved from Cuba, it goes through different stages of approvals and diligence studies. And normally in the articles of association and in the general business agreement, it's taken into account all these points, environmental issues and as well any potential liabilities that the business may have regarding the society or the environment. The new law has a chapter only focused on the environmental issues as well. So that's important to take into account as well. And as well, the Cubans normally are 51% of the share stake of the company. So they will be taking into account all these matters during the life of the company. And in addition to this, the company and the business has to be approved by either the Council of the State, either the Council of Ministers, or the chief of the specific organism within which the business is involved. So, for example, if it's the Ministry of Industry or the Ministry of agriculture, etc. So they're always looking after the business, not only when it is approved, but also in the day-to-day of the business. Regarding telecommunications and any other imports that may be coming from the United States, I was as well surprised by the announcements in January, because they, it appeared that they didn't take into account the Cuban reality. Obviously, the only companies that can import goods, not only from the States but from any other country, are state-owned companies or joint venture companies, which are 51-49%. There are some exception of companies that are 100% owned by foreign investors that have the licenses to import specific goods. But all the companies that are importing, for example, from the United States can be summarized in one, which is the all import, as we said before. So you're always dealing with the Cuban state. As well, it is difficult to sell from an individual entrepreneur to the United States potential clients any service that is a tangible asset. I mean, you can always sell a translation, you can always sell an accountancy service, or you can always sell an English class or a Spanish class from Cuba. But it's difficult to sell any art or any furniture or whatever is produced in Cuba, because you will have to pass through a public company. And then about telecommunications, Cuba has recognized that they need to import around 1 million computers. But obviously all those computers and all that technology, all those goods, would be used for the for the public sector or for the public-private sector in these joint venture companies and businesses. So as well, you'll be passing through the state. And in Cuba, they have an infrastructure problem with the telecommunications, as it happened with the telephones in the 90s. They have still digital technology or infrastructures, and they have to adapt it to analogic. So even if we wanted to give internet to all the Cubans in the island, there should be major investments in infrastructure so that it can reach all those homes. Right now in Cuba, the 1 megabyte of internet per month has a cost of $180. If we take into account that a Cuban, an average Cuban earns around 25 to 35 US dollars, that is a small treasure for them. Additionally, they have Nauta rooms that they want to develop, and they want to open 136 Nauta rooms, which is navigation rooms, sorry, which are rooms where they have 4 to 5 computers, and they charge 4 US dollars per hour of internet. And they want to, there are now 200 navigation rooms, and they want to increase it to 400 navigation rooms. So, I mean, that's a major sector that both the American, the U.S. government and the Cuban government want to be developed, but they have to see all those small engineering things to make things happen.
I just add one little piece on the CSR question, and I'll leave all the legal stuff to Gus. Totally agree with Omar and Jose Maria about the way the to the extent it's explicit, it's not explicitly covered, but the extent it's dealt with, it's inside of the approvals process, et cetera, et cetera. The one thing I would add, foreign companies nowadays, inbound companies, American, Canadian, whatever, have a CSR component now almost invariably. And in the olden days, for any of you who have been around, were around in Cuba, say, you know, in the 90s or something, there used to be an old ministry called called MINVEC, which was the Ministry for Foreign Collaboration, who were highly politically sensitive to humanitarian, you know, CSR stuff because of a sense that the state should not be embarrassed because it can't supply services to its own people. That was very much the prevailing kind of political wind at the time. That's all gone. There's a strong CSR and community engagement piece in almost everything they do. Sherritt runs huge community development programs, and all companies do.
Yeah, to touch on your earlier comment that technology and communications have evolved, I had the privilege of representing Airbnb on its launch of its services in Cuba. And so there are things that the current law allows. They're, I think, pretty significant and revolutionary, and I'm very happy to have helped with that. But the other issue of I'm going to invest in a telecom system, you know, it used to be that the law focused on an American company's ability to connect
the United States to Cuba, and that was okay. But then the idea that the United States would invest in diffusing that signal within Cuba was forbidden. And what the administration is now saying, no, that's okay. You can invest on the Cuba side to diffuse the signal. And I think that that's where the debate is, and I think that that's where that legislation hopes to accomplish. You know, I'm not in the political risk game of, but I think there are a lot of things that indicate that type of legislation has much better chance than it did, you know, 4 years ago, 5 years ago. I think in the U.S. you're seeing a confluence now that's growing on the Republican side in particular to kind of engage with Cuba to see potential opportunities, and they have organized themselves with some, I think, significant players and efforts. And so I think that the idea that perhaps lifting the travel ban would be first and perhaps clarifying the telecom legislation, I think those are two things that bear watching, because I think the prospects are much more favorable than they would have been 2 years ago.
Okay, thank you. I think we have time for another round of questions, and I have Andres, and if any of you... Yes, Chantal, and then... Okay, I'll keep a list. Just raise your hand, but we'll start with Andres.
I'm Andres Fanjul. I was born in Cuba. I'm a Cuban-American businessman, and I'm an investor, invest in foreign countries, and it's great to see Cuba now becoming an area that we're talking about. If Ted, I think 4 years ago, we would have never thought we would have been where we are today at the table talking about foreign investment. You know, investment in any foreign country is not a perfect world. We go in with a lot of reservations, a lot of issues, and we all have criteria to invest in whatever country we want to invest in. But I see Cuba going through what I would call an evolution of the revolution, if you want to call it, where... you know, they're opening up the relations to the U.S. or becoming closer, U.S. closer to Cuba. It's not without issues. It's not without criticisms. But it's something that I think is closer, and I think it's good. It's also good for U.S. businesses to be involved more in Cuba, as it is for American people to be able to visit Cuba. It creates a relationship between the people, which is very important. You all brought up so many issues. Your presentations are all excellent. But at the end of the day, there's always limitations on this. But the biggest limitation we all face on foreign investment is the U.S. embargo. And really, that question that I want to ask all each of you, I guess, separately is the embargo not an embargo on U.S. businesses and U.S. companies and U.S. individuals from visiting Cuba like you can elsewhere in the world?
Thank you. Thank you, Andres. I will take Chantal's question, and if anybody else wants to jump in on this round, raise your hand.
Thank you.
Then we'll come back to the panel.
Chantal Agarwal with the American Bar Association. I wanted to follow up on Jose Maria's recommendation for liberalization of the legal sector. What are the prospects for legal profession reform in Cuba? Because as I understand it, lawyers currently work through what is known as these bufetes colectivos. And what are the prospects? Is it a short, medium, or long-term endeavor? Thank you.
Anybody else in this? Okay. Carlos, do you want to? I think right here in this.
My question is for Augusto. You mentioned that you were involved in facilitating some of the contacts or the legal background with Airbnb. Could you just describe a little bit more, share a little bit more about how that came about? And, you know, because I see it really, as I mentioned in my presentation, as a model of success and one of the few areas where we can say it was a win-win-win-win in terms of, you know, Cuban entrepreneurs, you know, U.S. customers, Cuban government, and the U.S. government. And I'd love to see that replicated. So I'm interested in to know how it happened.
All right. I think if we can just go back to the panel, maybe we'll start with Augusto at this end and then come back and then end with you.
Well, Airbnb is, it was a wonderful experience to meet an incredibly talented, intelligent group of young people who see the world in a quite different way and saw an opportunity. Their model was tailor-made for this opportunity. It doesn't require them to build anything on the island. They had in the past received requests from Cubans to rent their houses on the Airbnb platform, and there was some lawyer somewhere in, you know, in San Francisco that says you can't do that. It's illegal, right? The embargo prohibits an American person from any transaction in which a Cuban has an interest, direct or indirect, unless licensed, and there was no license to do it. And so when December 17th came along, they would looked at the new general TSP and said, wait, I think this is legal. We don't have to affirmatively block a Cuban from using our site. We went down to the island, did our due diligence, did what we thought was necessary here in D.C. and in Havana, and gave them legal advice, and it was really, you know, launched the button. They also were able to take advantage of the fact that there were already existing workarounds, you know, sort of mini Airbnbs in Spain and some other countries. And so Airbnb, in essence, kind of rolled them up like any other bigger name brand company might. And so those are the bigger stories. I think payment's always going to be a challenge because today we don't have direct banking relations between the United States and Cuba. I joke that my role with American companies is akin to the Larry Fishburne character in The Matrix. You know, I walk off a building, and I say, you can do this. You can do this with Cuba. And they're like, no, you're ridiculous. I can't walk off this building. And so it is with banking. Banks have not taken that next step. And so the Airbnb model and others have to triangulate or work around with all these rigmaroles that add a huge inefficiency to the system.
I won't deal with the lawyers of stuff or Airbnb, but the only piece I'd mention to Andres's question, and I'm not an American, but I do find I spend a lot of time in the United States, especially after December 17th, with you know your companies. There can be a sense that Cuba's kind of an empty vessel to be filled up, and we just got to wait a little bit to kind of go over there. I would take this opportunity to remind everybody it's a very hustly bustly place with a lot of people, you know, still there. And if there's one characteristic of Cuban economic development policy that I've certainly noted is a diversification of reliance. It's no accident that at the same time that that all the U.S.-Cuba stuff was unfolding, feverish activity was going on with the Europeans to redo the European Union political relationship. The Japanese foreign minister was there. The president of France came, of course. The Koreans. Korea doesn't even have diplomatic relations with Cuba. They gave the Central Bank of Cuba. It's not huge, but it's a 60 million euro line of credit. So all I am saying is that to go to Andres's point, in a way, American companies are caught in a very awkward, kind of bizarre place right now. I just let's stop there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess American companies they're stuck in as well. What I said before, I referred to the ship that everybody's unhappy because it never blows in the correct direction. Because they don't know where they're going. So no one's happy. If we compare it to the situation that the Europeans have, Europeans, they can invest in Cuba. But when we have developed the projects, and for example, we have been quite busy with a biomass project where the EPC company is a Chinese company listed in China, and the developer is a British company. It was extremely difficult to get the security package in place, and it was almost impossible to get any financing coming from any bank, any foreign bank, because the U.S. embargo, although it applies to U.S. persons, it has extraterritorial effects, and that is a fact. What happened is that European companies that had presence or that had interest in the United States, they were afraid in doing businesses in Cuba. or those companies that wanted to open the North American market, the U.S. market, they wouldn't do any business in Cuba. But after the 17th of December announcement, many companies have been asking us to do business in Cuba because as per the contradiction or the inconsistency within the U.S., and taking into account that it is normally the executive power, the one implementing the extraterritorial effect of the sanctions out of the country, is normally the Secretary of State Department, then they were less afraid of getting any extraterritorial effects. So they are now more willing to invest in the island. And they have this interregnum, they have this period of time until there is a waiving of the U.S. sanctions by the Congress, if there is, after 2016, to get in the island, do the investments, and have a stronger position towards any North American company that wants to invest. Brazilians, Mexicans, Chinese, Vietnamese, Angolan, Spaniards, British, Italians, French, they have been doing businesses for the past 20 years in Cuba. So that's one point. What would I recommend to American companies right now? I would recommend them to protect their intellectual property rights in Cuba. There is a registry. You can register your company names, trademarks, etc., so that when you get to Cuba in the future, you won't see someone else drinking Coca Cuba instead of Coca-Cola. That's one point. The other thing we recommend to our U.S. clients is to go there in one of those 12 categories, the one regarding market research, etc., and talk to the potential counterparties, the Cuban parties that would be negotiating, that would be their clients, that would be their partners, and see what they want, what they need, etc. And as well, to talk to the foreign companies that have been doing business in Cuba for the past 20 years to see the pros and cons and what exactly have been their challenges. Then regarding the legal profession, very briefly, it is true that the Cuban lawyers are either in companies, they either work for the state, the ones that are practitioners, or they are in firms, legal firms. These firms, they are either directly belong to the Ministry of Justice or through the Asociación de Bufetes Colectivos, indirectly belong to the Ministry of Justice. So the profession is not privatized and it's not liberalized. This means that at the end of the day, the Cuban lawyers, they are in the payroll of the Cuban state, which means that any foreign company, as for example Unilever, which we have the privilege to represent in the Zona de Maril, when they have to engage their Cuban lawyer, they have, they're engaging someone that at the end of the day is in the payroll of their counterpart, which is the Cuban state. So that's one point. If there was a possibility to privatize and liberalize the profession, it would be within one of the cooperative licenses, which means that you need at least three individuals, and they can start up a business. But for that, they would need a license. And until that comes up, they won't be able to develop their profession. It's not in the short, in the agenda right now, but it may come in the mid and long term, because to grant legal certainty to foreign investors, they will need to have lawyers that work only for them and do not have any kind of direct or indirect conflict of interest.
Quickly to answer, Andres. I'm gonna make Cuba is on the first floor. The U.S. is on the second floor. I'm gonna make a simile, and then there's a stair, and we're going up the stairs. And when we get to the end, the top, we have to eliminate one of the stairs that's missing, because that's the embargo, because that prevents us from getting to the economic conditions that we need. But also, we shouldn't grow desperate. We have to remember it's only 4 months since the 17th of December. And so I believe that the history, as the ambassador says, history shows that not everybody is prepared for such a rapid response. It requires time. It has to sink in, and it's got to be gradual. People have to change their mindset, and there are people that won't. Everything takes time. But what I'm sure of, rest assured, everyone, events like this will make it possible to create the necessary public opinion to know that a hindrance that blocks, that it's the embargo that's keeping us, that's one of the things that have stood in the way the most up till now. And there have been timid attempts, but it requires big the letters of intention and the interest that's been showed. It shows us that there's been interest in Cuba, and so this response is dialogue. It's Cuba hasn't set up an embargo against the U.S. It's the other way around. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Arrived at the end of our time, and thank you to all our panelists and to our audience for joining us. Ted Pacon gets the last word.
Yeah. Great. Well, it would really be impossible to summarize what we heard today. It's incredibly rich, and I want to thank everyone who participated. Thank you for all your wisdom and thoughts. Let me just give some very quick reflections. When I step back and think about where we are and what we heard today, it sounds to me like a dance of two elephants where they have, on one hand, they're stuck in their own places where they come from. In the case of the United States, we're stuck in a place called the embargo. There's a reason for the embargo. There's a lot of history behind it, but we are clearly stuck. And then the Cubans have a certain model, a socialist model, that they're trying to adapt to the new 21st century economy, but it comes with a lot of problems and a lot of challenges, and we heard about those in great detail. So the question is, how do you then get to something that's different, that's going to change? And it seems to me that the solutions on the table are really incremental, and it's going to take time. And so you see the big challenges that we've all heard about today, and then you come down to reality and you see what are a set of really rather incremental changes. And that's a bit schizophrenic and frustrating, but I feel like that's what we're taking away in the current situation. We heard from Juan Triana certain important takeaways around the macroeconomic trends, somewhat optimistic, looking at, say, a year or two from now. Let's see how that all plays out, whether it's in the tourism area, banking, foreign direct investment. But we also heard from our second panelist, especially Yaima and Saida, the real challenges on the front of fiscal revenue, tax structure, the basic incentives of the economy, the problem of wages and productivity. And will Cuba decide to kind of leapfrog ahead on the technology front, for example, or, again, for the protection of its model, move very slowly and cautiously and be kept, I think, perhaps a little bit behind from where it could be? We also heard about the microeconomic trends, the cooperatives, the cuentapropistas, what's happening in the services sector. A lot of interesting movement in those fields and a lot of hope. But in the end of the day, it's still the microeconomy. It's very small, and it's not really having the impact that Cuba needs to move ahead. We heard then about the role of the international community, both, of course, the United States with Stefan Selig in the beginning, what the president has been able to do, what Congress now could do, needs to do, very important looking ahead. But we also heard importantly about the Europeans and the Canadians and their experience on the island way ahead of the United States. But we also did not hear as much about the role of countries like China and Venezuela, maybe Mexico going forward, Brazil, of course, very important players in moving Cuba into a whole new place in the world. I think the discussion about the role of CAF from Germán Ríos is important to see an international financial institution come to the table and begin to engage more directly. And that's a very positive sign, I think, of what's underway. But at the end of the day, you have a situation on the ground that feels constrained, but with lots of windows of opportunity. And I think kind of your analogy about from the Matrix of kind of going off on a ledge is what's required here, some risk-taking to help move that forward. I want to, in particular, give thanks to Harold Chinkunas, who's the director of our Latin America work and has been very supportive of all of our work on Cuba. I don't see Ashley Miller Here she is in the back. Ashley is my research assistant who has made all of this happen. I can't tell you enough. All the details that go into bringing our Cuban visitors here, travel and everything else, it's always very complicated but very rewarding. Also Emily Miller, who's been helping behind the scenes. Special thanks to Richard Feinberg, who has really been the intellectual leader of our work on Cuba, and I rely on him a great deal for his wisdom and advice. Can I just ask you that you bring your headsets out to the desk when you walk out, any kind of garbage so that things don't spill on the floor, and we'll have transcripts online as soon as we can get them up, written, audio, and video, and look forward to seeing you again. Thank you for coming. Not easy to do. But.